This is an ABC podcast.
I'm not sure anyone likes going to the dentist, but some of us are flat out terrified by the idea. The sounds of scraping, the buzz of the drill, the pain of needles, the throb of fillings. It's enough to make some people avoid dentists for years. But if you go to see dentist Sharon Zaks, things look and sound quite different. For a start, she's very open to you bringing in your own version of pain relief. It might be a personal masseuse or even singing opera instead of having a needle. Sharon's empathy for her patients has seen her develop a whole new branch of dentistry. She's always been interested in treating people with dental anxiety. And over the last few years, she's realised how this anxiety can play out in strong ways for survivors of sexual assault, people who can find the experience of lying back on a chair and being seen to by a dentist really, really distressing. The story of one patient in particular led Sharon to change almost everything she knew about the power relationship between dentist and patient. Hi Sharon, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
The fear of dentists, it's probably up there with the fear of public speaking. Is that true for you?
Oh, my. That's a great question, considering my recent life.
Well, you recently gave a TED Talk to 5,000 or so people. How nervous were you?
Gosh, I don't know how to measure it, but if there's a scale, I'd be right up and over and off it completely. I was effectively pushed onto the stage because I was so incredibly terrified that I was clutching the poor backstage woman saying, I just don't think I can do this, I'm so sorry. Even though I had worked incredibly hard from the very beginning to ensure that I was able to have everything as a second skin, I knew it so well. I still really wasn't breathing, eating, all the basic functions were lost, and I thought I was going to faint for the hours preceding, and I didn't sleep at all for the whole week leading up. So I was sort of incessantly reciting the lines. So it was quite a process and an amazing day going from that terrifying agony of enormous fear through to this elated exhilaration afterwards.
What was it that you were so afraid of, do you think?
Well, there were lots of things. I think I'd like to do another TED Talk on the incredible, amazing images my mind happened to conjure, where fear can take you. So I was mainly scared of going blank, having stage fright, forgetting sort of at any point and really just standing there and having this most incredible humiliated embarrassment. So that was the main fear. I was very scared I'd faint, actually, on the day.
Once you were pushed on stage by the woman in the wings and you went in front of all those thousands of people and began speaking, did your nerves abate?
Not initially, but the audience were unbelievably supportive. If you watch the talk, you can hear them laughing at my first line, which wasn't meant to be a joke, actually. I was just sort of highlighting that I was sort of like a fear sandwich bringing together the fear of public speaking and dentistry. So when they laughed, I was enormously relieved. It felt really like they reached out and gave me a huge hug. And from there, I was actually able to connect and sort of stand and deliver. And I really savoured sending the messages and giving the words and sort of including people as high up in the rafters as possible. So it took about five sentences where I forced myself to feel my feet on the ground and breathe, and that allowed the lines to drop in, which allowed me to be enormously relieved that that was actually happening.
All the processes you never know. Were working. Words yes. were coming out. And what sort of reaction did you get to that talk? What did people tell you about it?
Wow, yes, I was utterly overwhelmed. It actually feels still surreal in the sense that I was just mobbed for the entire rest of the day and evening, and people were coming up crying and incredibly moved. I was so amazed, actually, at how deeply people were able to feel that it reached them.
What was it that you said that connected so strongly, do you think?
Well, there are a few levels. I forced myself to be really open and raw, vulnerable emotionally, because in fact I knew how scared I was and I knew that I sort of couldn't hide it. But because I am advocating the notion that we can really help each other reduce our fear and it just takes support and trust and compassion, I wanted to be an example for everyone I'm trying to help. So there was the level of everybody seeing me very openly wrestling my volcano and demons. And also everything I said seemed to touch various people in different ways. So For example, a woman came up and said, I've struggled with self-care for 20 years and my husband has never understood why. He just keeps nagging me to take better care of myself. But after hearing your talk and the example with Anna struggling with that, he finally gets why.
The fact that that went so well, has it given you a different kind of confidence, do you think?
Yes, I was baffled with how the experience had changed me, actually. It was a really... I needed to muster a lot of courage, and the way I was able to get through it was to focus really, really strongly on who I'm trying to reach and help and the importance of the messages that they need to be said, and that this is bigger than me and not about me. And so immediately after the TED Talk, I ran off stage and couldn't stop moving, just had all this excess adrenaline, and so had sort of 4 hours of interviews for various groups and Channel 10 and all sorts of people. And in the live stream interview for TED, which was immediately after, there were only 6 cameras on me, and I thought, I laughed to myself because that would have been very overwhelming up until TED, which was 15 huge cameras. So
it's all relative.
It is. And I think going back to work was like being on a pleasure cruise. It was back in my comfort zone and listening to music. And everything since has actually been much easier.
Tell me how your grandparents came to Australia, Sharon. What's their story?
They haven't told me in a lot of detail. There are certain things that they don't want to open up again because it would be just too painful for them. But they all escaped concentration camps. My one surviving grandmother, my dad's mum, is 96 and she survived Auschwitz. And they all had a very treacherous journey down to Australia, as it was at the time. They were displaced persons in Siberia after they were released from the camps. And they just went wherever they had people. So there was a cousin in Belgium, and that's why my dad's parents went there. So he was born there and they spent 3 years there. And then they had a cousin in Sydney, so they wherever people went, and it was usually either Israel, America or Australia after they were released. And my mum's parents, very much the same, really long trips on boats. They came with no language, nothing. They were just sort of starting again.
So you really grew up surrounded by a lot of survivors and children of survivors. What did you observe about the kind of character of those people? Did they have things in common?
Oh, yes, very much. That's a great question. Obviously, that was my reality. So I was sort of, it was part of my makeup, and I was picking things up even subconsciously right from the beginning. But certainly the most outstanding feature was their resilience and adaptability. So my mum's mum at 93 was still learning her 8th language, Italian. She was still studying every day. And they all just... If my dad's mum has a fall or anything that goes wrong, she will ring me and say, I'm so lucky. So she's just the resilience, the stoicism. They've really seen 2 world wars and enormous change, the whole technological revolution. I remember when my grandmother, my mum's mum, was bought a microwave and she said, what's this? I'm not going to use it. Get this away. And then within a week she was using it. So it was all very that they just got on with stuff, and really family was everything.
What kind of focus was there on you and on your generation of succeeding and flourishing in this place, this safe place that they'd found at the other end of the world?
Yes, it was such a contrasting landscape and culture for them, Australia, compared to Eastern Europe. My grandmother was the first woman to go to a university and study accounting in Krakow, which is very interesting. In terms of my sort of upbringing, there was a huge focus on education and opportunities and making your own success and being conscientious and really making the most of everything while we had it. Because there was this feeling that it could kind of all be taken away at any moment. So it was sort of, I grew up in Caulfield, which is the centre of the Jewish community, many different streams of it, and there's a big emphasis on education and philanthropy and learning ideas. And I was always very curious, and still am, and loved learning and ideas.
How did your mum and dad meet?
So they were both actually with other people when they met and, in fact, engaged. And my mum was in Melbourne and my dad was in Sydney. And so he studied dentistry in Sydney. And my mum was with a doctor fellow who had a friend up in Sydney who was a dentist, and so he brought my mum to a dental function, a kind of student ball, and they met up there, and within 10 days they'd decided to be engaged. And yeah, my dad proposed to my mum twice, both while crossing roads. And so
what do you mean? Why crossing roads?
Perhaps so that she wouldn't have time to think too hard. I'm not too sure. They're still very happily married.
Did she say no the first time? Why did he have to propose
twice?
She
said famously, this is not the time or the place. So it was quite funny.
So your dad was studying dentistry. Is dentistry something of the family business for the Zacks?
Well, it kind of is now. So obviously my grandfather, his dad, and my grandmother, his mum, came to Australia with nothing, and they went into women's clothing. So my grandfather was a ladies tailor, and they would work all day and all night just to sort of get themselves established. My grandfather, Zeta, his name, was a real perfectionist, and so possibly that's how I've inherited some very detail-oriented and precise, and my grandmother would fix clothes and then he would redo them afterwards, so that created quite a lot of tension.
Yeah.
And so dentistry was seen, and it was at the time, as a secure, very reliable job and a very well-respected job, so it would kind of offer a safe, secure life.
Was it expected then, as you were growing up, that that's what you would go into as well?
Actually, Mum and Dad were very open and kind of said, just do whatever you like. And I was never going to do dentistry because it was already taken by both my dad and uncle. So I actually didn't consider it at all until very late in the game, handing in my preferences in Year 12. And so I really hated the idea of narrowing down. I had interests across the board, and so the whole way through school I was thinking to study maybe art science because it kept your options open. I considered medicine, maybe neurolinguistics or genetics. I sort of had interests across the board.
Who changed your mind about what a dentist's life could be?
Well, my dad was a big inspiration. I saw his lovely connection with patients and the mutual respect and the fun that they had and how he was able to help them. So he was a big inspiration. But because he was my dad, and again, that was sort of taken, I wanted to be different and individual, I kind of had ruled it out. But he was an inspiration. But it happened when I met a colleague of his, who I later wound up working for, interestingly, which was really fun, and I sort of went to watch her just on the off chance. Somebody said, don't rule it out, because it did actually tick a lot of the boxes, dentistry, that I was interested in, like working with my hands and helping people, and I love detail, and I was very interested in the theory and medical knowledge, and I thought it would be a lovely way to help people. So I sort of thought, okay, I won't rule it out, and went to watch this lady at work. And she had a lovely, gentle manner as well, a lot like my dad. And then she went home and did some painting, and then she sort of took her kids out to the park. And I thought, hang on a second, this could really work for me in terms of allowing me to do music as well as dentistry. And I knew I sort of wanted to do some writing, and I knew that dentistry would kind of be half my life always. I had never imagined kind of owning a practice or doing it full time.
When did you start playing music?
Wow. When I was 5. Yes, I begged my parents for a piano. I can't remember what it was exactly that inspired me, particularly about the piano. I must have heard music, obviously. but I begged them for a piano, and I've still got that same piano in my living room. I absolutely love it. And so I started when I had just turned 6.
Did you have good hands for learning the piano?
Yes. It came very naturally, actually, unlike the trumpet. Yes. And I loved it from the very minute I started.
And you were getting lessons, and you were playing. Would you play the way you played, the style you played? Was that different when you were playing alone as opposed to when you were working with a teacher or performing?
Yes. Actually, it was this sanctuary of emotional connection with myself that happened when everyone was out. So Mum would often listen when I was practicing and sort of yell out various feedback and encouragement. And at lessons, I always wanted to progress and learn, and but I was more nervous. But really, when everyone was out, I let loose and I just expressed myself fully. I'd usually make myself cry, and I'd explore in the fullest way, playing with particularly what kind of chord progressions and melodies and rhythms elicited certain emotions. I was fascinated by how that sort of progression in time of those sounds could move me so deeply, and I was really keen to do that with other people, but very shy. I was painfully shy as a child. I wouldn't even look at people, actually. Yes, it was just a wonderful kind of... Immediately, as soon as the door would go shut, I would jump straight onto the piano.
Why did the trumpet enter the picture?
So I was 13 in year 7 at a very musical school that, once again, I'd begged mum and dad to send me to because of the music. And I was quite sick of carrying the keyboard to all the band practices at school because it's quite unwieldy. And I saw this really good-looking guy playing the trumpet, and it was shiny and I loved the sound. And I thought, gosh, that'd be a lot easier to carry. And so I just thought, there's not really many female trumpeters that I've seen. Actually, there were none at the time. And I thought, gee, it'd be a bit fun to kind of play the trumpet. At the same time, I took up modern Greek because I just thought, once again, just a bit of an unusual kind of choice. Why not?
And were you a natural with the trumpet the way you were with the piano?
No, not at all. It was hard work from day one. I had asthma, so I couldn't really breathe, and I didn't really have many lessons. I was sort of teaching myself from the beginning, which unfortunately led to doing it really much more in a laboured way than when I finally learnt how to breathe properly.
So why do you think you persisted with it when you already had a skill in a different instrument?
Yes, I never planned for it to go so far, and I was always more keen to be on the keyboard and play my own original compositions, because from the age of 6 I started to compose stuff as well. There was just such a high demand for the trumpet. So there was a shortage of horn players. There still is. Usually all the horn players I've played with in bands play in at least 4 other bands. It just took off in a performing sense. So because I also was very interested in performing and it was so fun, I just sort of followed the trail through to bigger and bigger gigs and more.
But wait
and more.
A minute, how does that fit when you're someone who's painfully shy, you can't look at people, but you love performing? How do those two go together?
I don't know. I think that's it's a very interesting combination. A lot of my friends who are performers are also very introverted, a little bit the same, and I have always wanted to perform and to show myself and share the truth of music and the truth of comedy and really be seen. They both coexist, if that's possible.
What about the modern Greek? Did you continue with that?
I did, yes, and it sort of turned out to be very useful. I can still use it with patients, and I travelled to Greece in the year 2000, and because I don't look Greek at all, blonde hair, blue eyes, I sort of was a bit of a spy or imposter. So people, I'd come into a shop and they'd talk about me, and then I'd answer them in Greek, and they'd all jump to the ceiling in surprise. So it was quite fun.
So you did go ahead and you put dentistry on the form, and you studied that, and you were playing music at the same time. How did you manage, or how have you managed to do both teeth and the trumpet? How do they coexist for you?
I also continued on the piano, and I sort of self-taught drums. I've kind of done a bit of drums, drum kit in bands.
And Russian on weekends.
But yeah. No, that was it. That's everything now we've covered it on. But yeah, the main one was trumpet, but I was still involved with piano and also composing. So I kind of played in various cabaret shows, the keyboard, and I used to accompany people for their music exams. So piano didn't kind of stop. But in terms of combining it with dentistry, I actually from the very beginning thought that they'd be a wonderful combination, and it really is. So I just always squeezed it in. I was working 6 days a week as a dentist for many years, including Saturdays, and I would usually just go straight to gigs after work, but not back again. And so it was, yeah, particularly the Saturdays for so many years were gigs every weekend in various venues and festivals, and just got more and more. At one point I was in 3 bands, actually, and so I just sort of...
What kind of music?
Oh, different, all different sorts. So I started off in lots of orchestras, the Victorian Youth Symphony Orchestra, and I played at Melbourne Uni for a lot of musicals. They had chess. I even stayed there at the time. It was really, really fun. So I'd go and study anatomy and then go and do a performance, and just the juxtaposition was wonderful through uni, and then even in high school I had a band, and we used to perform around Melbourne, so it kind of hasn't stopped. The most sort of active band that I was in over the last few years is called Madre Monte, and that's cumbia, ska, reggae, fusion, so sort of Colombian rhythms, big party band, 12 of us. There's another fun one called the Red Brigade, which was a very naughty group of women. We dressed up, obviously, marching, and then we would have a lot of fun with crowds doing funny things. And Abby Cardwell and the Chicano Rockers, a Mexican 60s rock band, and I was in an African band for quite a while, playing sort of upbeat African music. And I've kind of been in a klezmer band. I've got such a massive, broad taste in music.
You must have come home on such a high after playing, particularly that kind of music. How would you calm yourself down after a day of dentistry and then a night performing in a klezmer band?
Yeah, it was a massive problem, actually. I really struggled because I don't smoke, I don't drink. I remember asking a musician patient of mine how on earth he deals with it. And in the surgery, he said, "I find sex puts a good full stop to the evening." So that was for him. But I would often just sit and wait because I was pretty much adrenalized for 4 hours after every gig. I kind of worked it out. And playing in a Latin band, which was the longest running one, I was in it for about maybe 10 years, 15. And so I'd get home. We wouldn't get on stage till 11 because all of these Latin things get going really late. And then I'd get home at about 2 and then I'd be up till about 6. And often I would have started work at 8 that same Saturday. But obviously the whole rest of the weekend was sleep. So it was fun though. It was really,
really
fun. Could
you ever lie there and sort of work your way through dental anatomy or something instead of counting sheep to help your mind start to settle down?
I would read dental journals, yes. So after gigs I'd sort of look at, I'd sort of dance around the living room for a while and kind of get out the excess energy. But it was so strange to come from this incredible connection you have with the audience. Everyone's dancing in the music, really, really loving it. There's such a huge exchange between us and the audience. And very noisy, obviously. And then I'd come home to this silent house and sort of wash the dishes. And it was just a very strange adaptation back into the... And actually, dentistry was very good in terms of when I was studying music and having to practice the piano for 8 hours a day, which went for a couple of years. It's such a great thing as a grounding mechanism to serve other people, just to get out of my own head with whatever I was trying to work on and get back to giving to other people.
Tell me about, and this is a phrase I never thought I'd use, Sharon, the dental cabaret that you created.
Okay, sure. So that was back in 2002, and I just wanted to combine the worlds in a more obvious way. So I'd usually be kind of running from the surgery to the stage, and they were just two totally different worlds, which was quite fun. But I just thought, I think it's time to mix it up a bit. And I just saw this enormous gap where kids would come to the dentist, be brought by their parents until about maybe 25 or 20, and then they would rebel and stop flossing and stop looking after their mouth and say, "I'll be fine and I'm immortal and, excited at all." And
they'd go to yoga instead of going to the dentist. It's not a cool thing to do.
That's right. That's right. Better bring some flossing into yoga. That's a good idea. And so I just thought, I wonder how I can inspire sort of teenagers and young up to 30s and adults, because there wasn't anything in the sort of way of oral health education for adults that was directed. There's kind of Roger Rabbit, the bunny, and lots for kids, but nothing for adults. So I thought it's time to kind of give flossing a kind of sexy makeover. And I wanted to sort of bring in a lot of the oral health messages, but not in a didactic way. So I sort of hid them in songs. So talking about, you know, you're the boss when you floss with me, with regard to, you know, a couple who had a relationship where the woman would get turned on when he flosses her teeth. And so, you know, talking about going deeper under the gum. And so I sort of weaved them in. And that was a lot of fun. So I kind of composed all the music, and I collaborated with a friend who wrote the lyrics, and got a band together, and then we performed it. It went very well.
And what about patients coming to you? How do some of them use music when they're experiencing going to the dentist?
Oh, there's so many ways. Yes, there's a multitude of ways that music kind of comes into being a dentist, actually. But I offer everyone a music menu, and usually people bring in their favourite music. It's been proven to release dopamine and reduce pain in dental appointments, so it's not just a fun trick, and it helps me. So, yes, there's been a couple of funny incidents, as though often I'll have a big iPod and someone will say, "Oh, just shuffle it." And I usually buy whatever music people want. So I just go and add it to the collection. And one time there was a very, very prim and proper conservative lady, and she said, I'll just put it on shuffle. And Eminem came up swearing, so we had to quickly run and turn that off. But, you know, it really does help in a massive way.
What about your patient who's an opera singer?
Oh, she's a classic. Yes. There's a queue outside the door because she was trained by Dame Kiri Te Kanawa, and she used to be a nun, so she swears a lot. And it's utterly hilarious.
But and she sings while you're working on her teeth.
That's right, the whole way through.
So how is that even possible?
I don't know. I don't know how she doesn't drown, but she wobbles when the water's in her throat and she laughs at herself. And she really finds the sound vibrations more helpful than local. And I think she just gives us all a concert, effectively. But she's brilliant, yeah.
You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Sean, why do dentists have such a gothic, terrifying reputation? What's that all about? Where does it come from?
Well, indeed, I am on a massive mission to change that personally. We didn't have an illustrious beginning, and in fact, hairdressers used to take out teeth and
really?
Cut hair, hence the white for hair and red for teeth on those poles outside barbers' shops. And so they were called barber surgeons, and obviously there was no local anaesthetic, and so they used to give people shots of whiskey. The only procedure they could perform was extractions. They didn't know what plaque was until 1950, so things were very, very rough and basic. So, yes, when I tell hairdressers that that's what they used to do, they always
offer a cut and colour and a teeth extraction.
That's right.
Why was extraction such a common procedure until, like, really recently, like our parents and grandparents' generation?
Yes. Well, they didn't understand what caused infections in teeth. Again, they didn't know what plaque was until very recently. So all they could do was extract infected teeth. In fact, my grandmother had this done, and many, many in her generation. It's not that long ago. They would give extractions of all of the teeth as a wedding present to the husband so that he wouldn't have to pay for or deal with his wife's infections. And
So without actually having teeth that felt they were a problem, you'd go and have them all taken out?
Yep,
preemptively. As a wedding present?
It was a really common wedding present. So usually, but just for women, not so much for men, and that was sort of dentures from age 20 onwards.
And how well-fitted were dentures?
Terrible. It's like a wooden leg. It's just the most hideous, unethical thing you could ever imagine, but they thought that they were doing the right thing.
And given, as you say, this is before anaesthetic, how would they have done that? How would have women coped with that pain?
Yes, I think they were just slightly drunk. That was all they could offer, and possibly the dentist as well. And often, at the time, obviously, there wasn't high-speed rotating drills, so it was a foot pedal and a pulley system, and so the drills vibrated very, very slowly, like a jackhammer, basically. So things would have been incredibly unpleasant. It was just a nightmarish scenario for everyone, I think.
Nobody likes being feared, and so have dentists also suffered the legacy of that kind of phobia?
Yes, very much. And if you look at the portrayal of dentists in the media, it's effectively all about sadism and ripping people off, and it's mainly negative. So things have shifted so far from that. Huge technological advances. The way we do dentistry now is unrecognisable from those days, and it's all geared towards prevention and intervention at the earliest stages. Things now are just nothing like what they used to be. So I don't think the public portrayal has caught up very well.
Were you always conscious when you started practising that some of your patients were coming with real fear and anxiety about visiting you?
Yes, yes. So from an early age, actually from the very beginning, I found this enormous satisfaction from helping people through their fear. That trusted role is just such an honour to be in, and going through that process, helping to carry people through these incredibly difficult processes, was just really fulfilling to see, particularly the progress you could make once trust was built. And so I, from a very early on, I started to practice in 1999, was getting referred anxious people, and then they would refer their scared friends. And so I kind of built up a reputation straight away.
How do you work with people who come and are just scared?
Well, I have considered the experience from the minute they book their appointment and before they set foot in the practice, all the way through the process till after the appointment, and really thought through from the patient's perspective how to make things a whole lot easier. And everything that I do involves giving back power and control and choice to patients, because dentistry, just to get it done, is such a disempowering experience. They're not only the physical position of lying in someone's lap, but you can't really see what's happening, you don't have the knowledge, and you can't really speak or move, and you're numb, and so it's actually vulnerable no matter what your history. And so my big aim is to completely reconfigure the power balance, and in fact I sort of use it universally, even for people who aren't scared. But certainly with regard to anxious patients, it's critical to develop the trust and the rapport. And I really find listening with an unhurried attention and completely open mind, no judgment, really, really listening and with compassion, that's utterly critical. So the old model, when I was going through, we did the first 3 years with the medical students, they would say, your clinical judgment will be clouded if you get emotionally involved with the patient. And my contention is the opposite. If you're not emotionally open, people can't open up and tell you what their fears actually are. They just don't feel comfortable. And it's only when you sit and give them time and space and let the patient set the agenda, at least for the first part of the relationship and first part of appointments, that they tell you what's actually going on for them. And then you wind up saving a whole lot of time and trouble later. So I'll maintain that that's actually the faster way anyway.
How did a woman called Anna help change the way you thought about being a dentist?
Wow, yes. I met her when I worked in the country. So I actually already was very much working this way. But what was unique with Anna is that she is very intelligent and quite eloquent in expressing the impact the relationship that we had on her life. It was just something I hadn't recognised the potential of until then. Patients have always been very appreciative, but for Anna in particular, she spelled out what it was, and that really inspired me and motivated me to want to spread the word to other dentists about the fact that we really never know the impact we can have.
And what did she tell you? What was it that was significant about the way you were approaching her care?
Well, for her, she's a survivor of severe childhood trauma, and I knew that she struggled to look after herself. Like most survivors, they're taught that they're worthless and really struggle in lots of ways. So what she said is that I took her treatment seriously, and through me she kind of realised that she was actually somebody worth taking care of herself. And from that moment, she was able to recover self-worth and a sense of control over what happened to her body, and she was able to use that voice to get together with her first partner for 8 years, because she'd sort of lost faith in her ability to do that, and to go out and start working where she hadn't been able to. So I just recognised the enormous potential of the relationship because it was spelled out to me. I rang her to see how she was recovering after a procedure, because I ring everybody, and she just sort of said that, and it jolted me into such a kind of moved place. I was quite tired when I'd made the call just to see how she was going, and she said, yeah, don't underestimate the impact you can have, Sharon Zax, she said. Meeting you was a massive turning point in my life, and it's changed everything for me.
In order to work with her effectively, did you need to know about that childhood trauma? Did she need to talk to you about it?
Not at all. Actually, most people don't want to divulge details, and we absolutely don't need to know to help people just as well.
So how did you work with her? If it was something that she wasn't used to doing, what kind of approach and what kind of time frame did you need to help her change the way she looked after her teeth?
Well, it happened gradually. There were kind of little victories over time. She said she'd never felt heard or included in her care as much before. And we are, as humans, so sensitive to where other people are coming from. And so much of it is communicated non-verbally. So I used to ring Anna to tell her about procedures and options on the phone, because she found it tricky to concentrate in the dental chair, which is also really common. And just again, sort of, I recognised when she was in a really kind of fight or flight wound up state, and we would breathe together. Using humour was very, very helpful. We would have massive laughing session every appointment, and her laugh is just so raucous and wonderful, so I always enjoyed that. And she really appreciated just having all the knowledge up front and being able to anticipate things, being able to choose exactly how procedures are broken down. Me telling her how much longer things would take really, really helped, because emotions often only become unbearable because it feels like they'll never end. And so telling people so they really have no surprises and they feel in full control of everything that's happening. She's also a singer, so she used to sing through appointments, and that helped as well. We would often sing together through appointments, and things just shifted bit by bit. She would go often in cycles, because this is very, very common that depression kind of comes in cycles, and she really appreciated not being shamed or made to feel guilty when she would fall off the wagon. And it's just basic compassion and understanding. So I think this sort of trauma-informed approach is all about understanding why people react as they do. It is amazing that there are so many hidden ways trauma manifests in the mouth that we as dentists should be mindful of. And they are obviously injuries from assault, like broken teeth and bruising, but in a more insidious way, the coping strategies survivors often use from a young age to deal with pain and the awfulness of the trauma itself, like smoking, comfort eating, drinking and drugs, and they all damage the mouth in massive ways. So we need to be on the lookout for those and not judgmental of them either. And grinding and clenching and having a very heightened gag reflex. So all of those ways that trauma plays itself out in the mouth are very important.
What did you start to notice or realise in terms of the connections between the experience of sexual assault in particular and the experience of going to the dentist?
Yes, I picked this up also through a patient who I met in the country, and we started in 2012 to work together and made enormous progress over 5 or 6 years. She was the person that sort of got me thinking, because she was an open survivor. Again, that's very unusual to, she just came in and declared it up front. So I sat down and thought, my gosh, there are just so many parallels. I wrote a list of about 20 things between the two experiences.
Give me a sense.
So for example, lying in the lap of a trusted authority figure is a reminder of childhood abuse, which this patient had, and feeling immobilized is a reminder of being pinned down. Not being able to speak is a reminder of being silenced. Having your mouth filled up with fingers and instruments and staying open for a long time is a reminder of oral rape, which is really common, and accidental touching of bodies, invasion of personal space just because of the physical situation that they're lying so close to you. And really, trust has already been broken. So the offender kind of reassures them that their activities are safe and coming from a positive place, like teaching them. Often people are groomed and they start with things that are less and then ramp up. And so like them as dentists, we're reassuring them that what we're doing is safe, even if it's involving some discomfort and sort of in their interests. And so, of course, suspicious of being betrayed yet again. And latex, the smell, can remind people of condoms. The horizontal chair position is a massive trigger for memories to flood back. In fact, they've shown that memories can often only be unlocked when survivors are lying back in that supine position. So anything that is physically similar to the original trauma, because the body holds trauma in its own way as a memory, activates this fight, flight, panic as a survival mechanism.
When you describe it like that, Sharon, it kind of seems extraordinary to me that any survivor can ever go to the dentist. It sounds so fraught as
yes,
an experience.
It really is. And I think that's so I was in this position after I met this patient of becoming aware of these similarities just through thinking about it and conversations with her. And we were quite inspired by what we achieved together over a few years, getting her from a really, really scared, reluctant place, not being able to put her hands in her mouth to floss, which is universal among survivors of sexual assault that I've met.
Her own hands.
Her own hands, yes, because it just triggers too many memories. Having a very heightened gag reflex, once again, I've seen it across the board. And we got her flossing twice a day over years. Again, it takes time, but I think that delayed gratification is why I love it so much, because you start at a really difficult starting place, but the potential for change and growth is so massive. So, yes, it really changed how I looked at things, and I saw that There's a huge issue with widespread avoidance of dentists by survivors globally, and I saw that as dentists we're completely unaware of these issues, and that there were lots of reports of feeling re-traumatised where abusive dynamics were replicated unwittingly at dentists. So dentists, without realising it, were kind of triggering memories, and survivors would never feel confident to disclose either their history or what was going on, because up until very recently the responses have been just so unsupportive. And so, yes, I saw the disconnect on both sides, and I saw that the system isn't set up for dealing with trauma at all. So survivors often can't work because of PTSD and anxiety and depression, and so they don't have money, and then they have a huge need for a whole lot of complex dental work.
Well, as you're describing it, it sounds like kind of a perfect storm of conditions, because the context is so terrifying, you avoid the dentist. And then what kind of consequences can that have if someone just says, it's too horrible, I'm not going to go? What can that mean for people? What have you seen?
Oh, gosh, the consequences are disastrous. The mouth is just, again, so critical for self-worth. So often they don't feel like they can smile. If they have missing teeth or bad gum disease or bad breath, they're really self-conscious. And it winds up being a kind of vicious shame cycle. So the worse their mouth gets, the more they feel embarrassed to show a dentist. And it just perpetuates over and over. So,
well, what kind of things have you seen when patients have finally got enough courage to come and see you? How bad can it get?
Oh, I've seen everything. I've seen everything, being completely abscessed teeth about to all fall out from deep gum disease. I've seen survivors who've had car stereos thrown at their faces and broken all their front teeth off. I've seen people who can't talk properly because their teeth are so wobbly, so they lisp but can't really talk. Everything's waving in the breeze. I've seen really severe pain, and this is really common, unfortunately. They just delay looking after a toothache, so they'll usually put dentistry off or avoid it for. So I've seen really advanced decay, virtually nothing left of a tooth. People are driven to unbelievable levels of desperation to avoid coming. One time, this is a few years ago now, I saw a fellow who came in with a tampon string hanging out of his mouth, and I thought, oh golly, what's happening here? And he had used that to stop the bleeding, and out in his garage with a kind of rusty file, he had cemented his broken tooth back on upside down and the wrong way around, so it was sticking right up and he couldn't bite anymore, with super glue. So he said his stomach was a bit sore, and he had sort of filed it off with this rusty file as well, so there was all of these rust bits sitting in his mouth.
What did you do?
Oh, I just thanked him for coming in and congratulating him for having the courage to address it, and really made sure that he didn't feel judged at all. And then I had to drill off the tooth fragment and put it, sort of build up the tooth again. Yeah. But I also encouraged him not to do anything like that in the future, and I sent him for a tetanus shot.
Have you told other colleagues, other dentists, about what you found? How have they reacted to this?
Yes, well, the first time I have unleashed all my research was a few weeks ago at the Australian Dental Association Annual Congress in Adelaide, which is the biggest gathering of dentists in the Southern Hemisphere. So I was enormously excited to actually start to inform colleagues, and it was received really warmly. I was so overwhelmed. I actually didn't expect this to happen, but after I got off stage, I had at least five male survivor dentists come up to me crying, saying, you've just told my story, and I haven't been able to talk about this with anyone else. And so that was a very moving situation. But yes, everybody were immediately saying, I'm never going to practice the same way again. We've got this new awareness.
How will they practice differently? What will a dentist do differently who's aware of this?
Yes. For the Dental Congress, what I delivered was a much more technical talk, a lecture, with regard to the specific fears and behaviours to look out for, so that we can put a picture together that our patient might be a survivor, because there are some really common fears and behaviours, I can tell you in a minute, and how to respond sensitively if a patient discloses their sexual assault history to us, what to say, what not to say, and practical management strategies. So there are quite a few different things for dentists to be mindful of, but certainly recognition of someone with that background would immediately now trigger quite a different set of ways of working together.
How might a patient present if they have that background and they haven't wanted to acknowledge that or explain that to someone who, you know, may be a stranger that they're frightened of?
Yes, of course.
What might a dentist be able to pick up on?
Well, there are specific fears and behaviours, and again, this is, everybody responds so differently with sexual assault, and people cope with and tackle situations in very different ways. But these are some of the most common kind of dental fears and behaviours. So the biggest one is fear of the lack of control and fear of having an embarrassing panic attack, which has often happened when the memories get triggered. The fear of not being able to breathe, gagging or vomiting during treatment. So there's a lot more difficulty with instruments, particular instruments, which go into having them in the mouth. Also, fear of anger, criticism and judgment from us as dentists. That's the biggest differentiator between dental anxiety from a survivor of sexual assault versus dental anxiety from something like a bad dental experience. So that fear of anxiety, criticism and judgment is really, really important that we handle sensitively, because trauma changes the brain in a way that makes people much more prone to see everything around them as a threat and much more likely to perceive blame for things. Particularly with regard to survivors of sexual assault, they're usually taught that they're to blame for everything that happened. And so usually if there's any upset or anger or disgust, a survivor will pick up on that in the room and take it on as their own and feel really bad about it.
If a survivor does get to have a good experience with a dentist, there's the obvious benefits in getting dental health care. What else positive can happen out of that interaction?
Oh, so much. Yes, we're in such a unique position as dentists to help actually heal their trauma, which was something that wasn't understood until very recently.
Don't you need to be being a psychologist to do that, Sharon? Are you healing trauma?
No. It's thankfully, no. That's what a lot of dentists said at the Congress. Isn't this out of our realm? But not at all. It's a very intimate relationship where we're dealing with people's bodies and also psychology and emotions. But amazingly, all that's necessary to heal from trauma is to have nurturing, compassionate relationships where people really feel heard and understood. And that is what triggers a huge biological reaction with gene expression and stress reactivity and immune system function changes. So
on like sort of quite a deep bodily level, there can be a change from this sort of positive interaction.
Absolutely. And I've seen it in patients when they don't feel judged or shamed, and everything that they come in with is fully accepted and understood. All their what their worries they say are crazy are validated as absolutely normal and expected. It's like they drop 20 kilograms on the spot. I just see this shedding of a huge burden, and it's amazing the transformation that can then happen very quickly. Often they cry, and that's why we need to be so comfortable with emotions as dentists. Again, that's not been traditionally taught at all. And so when people open up and cry, That's when you can really start, actually. But for survivors, they can, particularly the self-worth element is massive, where they can take that into the rest of their lives, like with Anna. And they are able to get a sense of empowerment and move out of that victim mentality that has often defined their identity up until then. So it's amazing. Sometimes survivors of sexual assault have never had a relationship that's not based on a winner and a loser. And so you're able to model good boundaries where you can ask them what's okay, what's not okay. Often they say, oh my God, I've never had a chance to even say this. And they have such glee saying, oh, can you put the suction there rather than there? Like simple things, but just exercising that control again just becomes this enormous window. And I often find that they feel affirmed in ways that they've never felt affirmed before, and that can be very profound for them. Their capability, just believing in their capability, usually people will say, I don't understand why you have faith that I can do this. But then over time, if I'm a sort of rock that they can bounce off, and I just sort of really communicate that faith I have in their capacity, they live into it, and then they can't believe it themselves, and it sort of opens up all these other elements in the rest of their lives.
What sort of behaviours or techniques have you seen people use in your dentist office to help them manage some of their stress and anxiety? You mentioned singing. Yep. What else have people done that are helpful?
Well, I've sort of worked these out, these practical coping strategies, over the last 20 years. So having a support person present has been a real help, because they can get driven there and back, and the support person can often remember what I'm saying in terms of instructions, because often the patient is in a fight, flight, nervous mode. So that's a real help. Little things like having a rolled up towel or back cushion, which opens up the chest and helps people to actually breathe properly, because breathing is so crucial to breaking that fight and flight response. And I often use what's called the fidget widget, which has a series of buttons and wheels, and just that physical touch is a really lovely distraction and brings people back into their bodies out of their worrying head, even down to, starting with a glass of water in the waiting room and who walks in first when going to the surgery. I've really considered the sensory experience, not hovering over patients, keeping at eye level, having the door open, daylight in the surgery. So this particular patient up in the country, there are a lot of eccentric people. She made all her own clothes. She used to boast about practicing the flute in the shower while she ate her breakfast as well. She's a classic. And she came in and I was working on her teeth one day. We were working quietly, sort of in a flow, which was really lovely. And all of a sudden I heard, "I'm your guardian angel," emanating from her crotch. And I don't know, I got a real fright, but I didn't jump, and the nurse started laughing. And she pulled out this doll from this pocket that she had in her skirt, which had about 18 pockets, but this was her underpants pocket. And she pushed this button, and so she would do that. I think she got a great thrill out of frightening us. It was really funny. And so every visit she would bring that in, and she became known as that patient in a lovely way. And she would just push the button when she needed a little bit of support from this doll. People are wonderful. And just the way that they kind of show themselves authentically, it's very, very lovely.
I think you really made the right decision when you ended up ticking dentistry on that university application
form. Thank you. I'm very happy. Yes, I think that I'm very excited about the future. I think that there's enormous scope to make things so much easier and more fun. I ask patients, how can I make this more fun every day? And they usually laugh. But we do. We wind up having fun.
I've had fun talking to you, Cheryl.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, pleasure. Great to be here.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, abc.net.au/conversations.
My interview with Sharon Zaks will be up on the Conversations website soon. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.